Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to blow the whistle on some of the most powerful officials of a country, and is clear evidence of corruption enough to cut the offenders off from their graft? My guest today will tell the story of an idealistic young Kenyan named John Githango, who early in 2003 started work as the country's permanent secretary for governance and ethics, a sort of anti-corruption czar, reporting directly to Kenya's new president. Although Githango and many others believed the new post signaled a turnaround in Kenya's notoriously corrupt government, he found himself surrounded by officials who were eager to use their newly won political power to line their own pockets. Michaela Wrong is a journalist who spent 6 years covering the African continent. Her new book is called It's Our Turn to Eat, The Story of a Kenyan Whistleblower. Michaela, welcome to Think.
Thank you for asking me.
I want to start here by talking about the title of your book. Can you explain what the phrase, our turn to eat, means colloquially to Kenyans?
Yeah, it's a phrase that you hear a lot in Kenya, and I became quite sick of it, which is why I decided to use it as my title. It really means that there's been a system of rule in Kenya since before independence, where one ethnic elite, one ethnic community would take power. And, of course, it began with the white settlers, and really run the country for the advantage and the benefit of their own community and not really care too much what happened to everyone else. So when it came to investment in the infrastructure, in the roads and the streetlights, that would go to your local area. When it came to contracts, that would go to your ethnic community and those businessmen. When it came to jobs, it would be jobs for the boys, jobs for the guys from upcountry. And I began to see when I was reporting on Kenya for the Financial Times that this was this went to the heart of the corruption system in Kenya, because each ethnic community that seized power and that got to control the presidency would then run the country for their own narrow interests and you know, devil take the rest of the country.
And can you give us a rundown of some of the most, there are a lot of tribal affiliations within Kenya, but there are a few groups that have the largest percentage of the population that sort of compete for the presidency every time.
Yes, there are always competing statistics. I mean, some people will say, oh, 19% or 20% or 11%. So let's not go into those. But, I mean, you have the Kikuyus are a very large group who are extremely, you know, the stereotypes are often have an element of truth to them. So the stereotype about the Kikuyus that they're very successful in business, very capitalistic, entrepreneurial group, and of course two of Kenya's presidents have come from that ethnic group. Then you have the Kalenjin, who traditionally were more pastoral people. The second president, Daniel Arap Moi, he was a Kalenjin. Then sort of smaller groups, Kambas, Luyas, and so it goes on. I mean, altogether we're talking about 48 different ethnic communities. So it's a very diverse population, but there are sort of five or six key groups that predominate.
So the current president, Mwai Kibaki, who was elected at the very end of 2002, is Kikuyu, so that brought them back to power.
That's right. And he, I mean, one of the great criticisms people made against him very soon after he won those elections was that he was surrounding himself exclusively with people from his own area.
And can you talk about the people that he brought into his inner circle? They were almost primarily Kikuyu, but did they have certain qualifications for the jobs that they were given?
Yeah, they were Kikuyus, but they were also Meru and Embu, who are neighboring communities from this area around Mount Kenya. And so very quickly this became known as the Mount Kenya Mafia in the Kenyan press. And there was a feeling that these, some of them were had been human rights activists, lawyers who had played a very active role in campaigning for constitutional reforms under Moi. But there were also people whose qualifications were not at all clear, who had been bankrupts or who had sort of failed in their careers beforehand. That was certainly one of the accusations made against the internal security minister, who had run a pharmaceuticals company. And what was very quickly noticed was that these people had gone from being really strapped for cash to suddenly having very nice large villas in both upcountry and in central Nairobi. And it didn't seem to tally really with what they were earning.
So one of Kibaki's first official acts, which would seem like a sign that he wanted to turn the system around, was to hire this guy, John Githango. Can you tell us a little bit about Githango's background?
John Githango was really part of that patrician elite in Kenya, very well connected. His father had done the accounts, run an accountancy firm, and had done the accounts for Jomo Kenyatta, the first president of Kenya. This was a family that hobnobbed with the other members of the Kikuyu elite. But John was a little bit more of a radical, you could say. I mean, he went to one of the top schools, but then he went into journalism, which is always a sort of subversive kind of career to have. And then he got very heavily involved in the anti-corruption movement, and he had been the director of Transparency International, which is a very prominent anti-corruption organization. So it was an interesting thing going on, because the people who had appointed him anti-corruption czar in the government clearly thought that they were giving the job to a safe pair of hands. They knew his father. You know, this was somebody who, you know, he was friends with their sons. He was part of that elite that lived in sort of leafy Karen, a suburb of Nairobi. And there was feeling that he could be trusted, but they didn't really look closely enough at who he was. And he was, in fact, somebody who had been a journalist, had worked in the independent NGO sector, very passionate about the anti-corruption movement across Africa and the world, and who actually really wasn't necessarily going to play ball in the way they expected.
Why do you think it didn't occur to Githango that he was viewed as the safe choice, despite his muckraking background?
Well, I've discussed this with him, and there has been an accusation that people will make to him about him, and often to his face, and they'll say, John, you know, you're so naive. How could you have thought that you would get into government? And look, many of these people had served in government before. They, you know, they're part of the old system. How could you believe that you were going to go in there and change things, and that that everything was going to be squeaky clean in the future? And I think he would answer to that, look, you know, there was a sense that Kenya in 2003 was really seeing something of a second liberation. It had freed itself from this very authoritarian leader, Daniel Arap Moi. People were fed up with the repressive regime of the past, and they were fed up with the corruption, and they realized that there was a problem there. And he said, you know, you've been appointed, you're a patriotic Kenyan, this is a government that is saying all the right things, and if you don't help them, if you stay outside the system and just sit there carping and criticizing, then you don't have a leg to stand on, because they asked you for your help, they asked you for your advice, and you didn't give it. So he actually sort of felt obliged to take that job.
At the beginning, he certainly had extraordinary access to the president. How did he use that?
Yes, he didn't have the powers to arrest people himself, but he was essentially supposed to act as a catalyst. And the president had said to him, let me know what's going on. Be my eyes and ears. And he did have great access, and they had a very good relationship. So he would go straight into the president's rooms, and he would draw up memos and briefings and just tip the president off as to what was going on. And at a certain stage, of course, he began tipping the president off about this new corruption scandal that he was beginning to collect information on, which involved people within the government himself and some of the members of that Mount Kenya mafia.
Did Githango enter the job expecting that he would, in fact, find corruption pretty soon after he took the job?
I'm sure he did expect to find it. I think what he never expected was that he would come across a major scandal which involved people who were so close to the president and so close to him. I mean, these were ministers, these were the key ministers in government, the people who held the real power and also who held the real purse strings, and that they would be directly involved, that this wasn't just a case of small bad apples lower down, that this was the really the key players in government who turned out to be involved in this this new scandal that came along, which was called Anglo Leasing.
Yeah, let's talk about Anglo Leasing for a minute. There were top ministers in the government who essentially created what amounted to a shadow corporation.
It wasn't just one shadow corporation. I mean, it's called Anglo Leasing, but in fact, that was just the first company. There were 18 of these companies, and they were just street addresses. A lot of them were street addresses in Britain and Liverpool. And what was happening was these sizable contracts were being signed by the ministers that John was talking to on a regular basis. They would sign off on these military security contracts for naval frigates, for helicopters, for passport issuing systems, for radio telecommunications systems. And then either nothing would be delivered at all, or something that was clearly not worth the money that had been paid for it. And then the money was flowing out of the treasury, taxpayers' money, very little coming back. And what John realized and was being told very quickly by his informers was that the money was really going back into the accounts of the civil servants and the ministers who had signed off on those deals.
And in fact, the amount of money lost was even greater than the amount of money that was coming in from foreign aid.
Yeah, it was about level pegging, because what happened under this new government is that the donors who had stopped lending money and stopped giving money to Kenya because they had found it so difficult to deal with Moi, the former president, they had started to resume funding in a big way, to resume aid. And it is extraordinary that the amount of money, I mean, these sums involved in Anglo Leasing, more or less $1 billion we're talking about. And that was just about the aid budget of those years as well.
Can you talk for a minute about how Githongo cultivated the sources that he needed to collect the documentation that he finally did?
Yes, that was very interesting. John is somebody with huge personal charisma, and someone who can talk to little people as well as big men. He's a guy who people instinctively confide in, and big men will confide in him and tell him their secrets. And secretaries would confide in him, civil servants, clerks, messengers. He had sources everywhere throughout the government system. He was on good terms with national intelligence as well, and he also knew a lot of businessmen in the private sector who started to get very worried about what was going on. And he had an open-door policy, and people would just go and see him and start telling him about these dodgy contracts, and then they would start feeding him documentation. And often these would be slipped to him secretly. Sometimes he'd drive to a sort of petrol station in the middle of the night, take delivery of some key piece of paperwork. And, of course, at the same time, he was doing another form of information collecting, which is that he was taping conversations with a lot of the key people in the Mount Kenya Mafia. He had decided that he needed to do that to protect himself, because he didn't want to end up being used as a fall guy if this scandal came to light. And so he had mic'd himself up secretly, and when they started being more and more open with him and telling him that they were involved in Anglo Leasing, he was taping those conversations.
It's really extraordinary and almost hard to get your mind around the fact that they so assumed that the system would continue the way it had, that they were willing to tell this guy, the anti-corruption czar, about their involvement.
I think it shows how much confidence they had that he would play ball. It never occurred to them that he wouldn't just see it from their own perspective, and that's why they were so open with him. They had the arrogance, that confidence that went with he's one of ours. He won't let the side down.
Journalist Michaela Wrong is my guest. Her new book is called It's Our Turn to Eat, The Story of a Kenyan Whistleblower. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Michaela Wrong. Her new book is called It's Our Turn to Eat, The Story of a Kenyan Whistleblower. You can be part of this conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Michaela, I wonder if you can talk for a minute about how this level of theft that was taking place at the highest levels of the government affected regular people in Kenya.
Yes, I think one of the problems in Kenya is that it's been the scene of many scandals, large-scale scandals. I mean, this is what happened under the previous president, Moi. There was a huge scandal called Goldenberg. And often the problem for ordinary Kenyans is that they don't see the connection between these massive top-level scandals where the treasury is effectively plundered by the ruling elite and their own living standards. But, of course, you can't steal that amount of money and send it off into private bank accounts abroad, which is what we have to assume has happened in so many of these cases, and not affect the economy of a country. And you have this staggering statistic that at independence, Kenya was level pegging, really, with Malaysia. Now, you know, you look at Kenya today. It's a very, very poor country, and Malaysia is doing incredibly well. And there's a lesson there for the system of rule that has predominated there. And if you visit Kenya today, what's really striking is that you get some very plush, green, leafy suburbs nestling side by side with some of the worst slums in Africa, Kibera, Mathari, Kawangware. If you live there, you will know people who live in those slums, and they're really just shacks with sort of common latrines and muddy paths running down the middle. And living standards are absolutely appalling in those places. So the impact on ordinary lives has always been enormous, but it's not been generally recognized. And I think one of John's achievements is to try, you know, he's tried to make that link clear to people, and I think he has succeeded to a certain extent.
So it sounds like there has been, at least in the past, a sort of weary acquiescence to this. People just assumed that that was the way things worked, and that they didn't, whether or not they knew about a scandal taking place, that they didn't really have the power to do anything about it.
Well, I think what happened is you often had the excuse used, which is the title of my book, It's Our Turn to Eat. Mm-hmm. And there was a sense that these top-level scams, which really benefited just the elite, were camouflaged and disguised as a sort of community effort, an ethnic community effort, that, you know, we're your minister, we're running a department and a ministry on your behalf, we'll make sure that jobs go to people from our community. Kenya is a very tribally hypersensitive place, and so the minister of the day would camouflage what he was doing by saying, I'm doing this on your behalf. This is the game. This is the way it is played. And I'm making sure that, you know, my constituencies benefit, my community benefits. And therefore, people felt that there wasn't much point objecting because this is the battle that was taking place in post-independence Kenya, which is this rivalry between the various ethnic communities.
How did Githango start to realize that he was going to have to leave the country before making his accusations public?
He was under terrible pressure. He was being threatened with death, getting a lot of anonymous phone calls in the middle of the night. He'd pick up the phone and someone would growl down a threat over the phone. That's not a very pleasant thing to live through. And he was also being explicitly threatened by the people he worked with, by his fellow ministers, who would jokingly sort of suggest to him that if he carried on doing what he was doing, you know, he wouldn't be around very long. But I think the real turning point, if you talk to him, was that at a certain stage, the key ministers, the people I mention in my book, started coming to him, and they were being so open with him and so unguarded in what they said that he had to assume that President Mwai Kibaki had given them the go-ahead. And since he regarded Mwai Kibaki's backing as being absolutely crucial to what he was trying to do, once he realized that Kibaki was no longer on board, then he felt it was just time to get out. And he got out. He needed to clear his mind and work out what he was going to do. He was afraid. He thought he was in physical danger. And he just couldn't really stand it anymore. And that's when he turned up in London on my doorstep.
Yeah, he hid in your apartment for a while.
Yes, that's right. I mean, this is how I first heard about the story, because we'd been friends for a while. We'd known each other when we were both just journalists in Nairobi, long before he joined government. And fairly unexpectedly, I got a phone call from him. He was traveling in Europe saying, can I take you up on the offer you once made of a room in your flat? And I said, well, that, of course, you're always welcome. And can I mention this to other people? I know other journalists in London would love to talk about Kenyan affairs with you. And he said, no, please keep it to yourself. And when he turned up, he told me that he was going to ground and that he didn't want anyone to know that he was staying with me. And he also asked me if I could help him resign because he needed to send off his resignation letter to State House.
And that's essentially when the story broke.
The story broke that he had left, and that there was this mystery departure and mystery resignation. But the full story only broke a year later when a dossier that he had compiled that detailed all of this Anglo leasing scandal was leaked to the press. And John was behind that leak. And it really was him exposing, spilling the beans, letting the fresh air into this very musty business that had been this nasty scandal.
Journalist Michaela Wrong is my guest. Her new book is called It's Our Turn to Eat, The Story of a Kenyan Whistleblower. If you want to join the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Bill in Dallas. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Excellent program as always. I wanted to say, first of all, that I loved both of the books on the Congo, Footsteps of Kurtz, and I Didn't Do It for You about Eritrea. We have a very large Eritrean and Congolese expatriate community here, and I loved both of those books. But my question is, given the level of corruption in Africa in general, whether or not what the West should do in order to send assets or charitable giving there. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Bye.
I'm glad to hear he's read my other books and has enjoyed them. I think one of my main messages is that the West should be very discerning when it comes to bilateral aid, and that's the aid that the government sends to the Kenyan government, the U.S. government sends, my government sends, and also, of course, there's a lot of World Bank money and International Monetary Fund money going into Kenya. And I think, we have to be very careful and watch very carefully what happens with that aid. And I think what we haven't done in the past is ring the alarm bells when they clearly needed to be rung. We had, in Kenya, we had a very vocal British High Commissioner, Sir Edward Clay, who gave what were regarded at the time as very provocative speeches highlighting Anglo-leasing. But he really wasn't typical of the aid community, and he was really frozen out and eventually silenced, I would say, by the British system. He retired, and there was a sense that the people replacing him, the new High Commissioner, didn't have the same approach at all. So I think it's about being provocative, being confrontational, making it clear when you do uncover a major scandal of the likes of Anglo leasing, that this is not acceptable and that the relationship will suffer as a result. When it comes to charitable givings given by individuals and by non-governmental organizations, I think, that often isn't going into government hands. That's going to grassroots organizations, which are doing tremendously good work often. It's not always the case. But I think, Kenya is a country at the moment where corruption, official corruption, is such a blight that if I was giving money, I would want it to be going into the NGOs, especially local grassroots NGOs, and not through government.
What is your assessment, Michaela, of why so many international governments seem to have turned a blind eye, not just to the Anglo leasing scandal, but to a long history of official corruption in Kenya?
Well, there was always a strategic issue in Kenya, which is that this was regarded traditionally as being the stable linchpin nation in East Africa. And if you look at the neighbors, look at Somalia at the moment and the way that's imploding. Look at Sudan, which is looking pretty fragile itself. Uganda, Rwanda. I mean, everyone wanted to keep Kenya on board because there was a feeling that this was the one state that had got its act together and could be relied on. I think there was a large element of fantasy about that attitude. And I think what happened after the elections last year, which were the bloodiest in Kenyan history, really exposed how faulty that assessment was. So that was one issue. But you also have to see that there's been a history recently after the Gleneagles G8 summit in 2005. There was this real drive to up aid to Africa. And people felt that there just hadn't been enough. There's the Jeffrey Sachs school of thought that, you know, the reason aid hasn't been effective in Africa is there simply hasn't been enough of it, and it's too much of it has been tied. And the problem is that in that drive to increase aid, I think a lot of discrimination has been lost. And when the evidence suggested that the governments concerned in Kenya's case were not worthy recipients, that they couldn't be trusted to spend that aid wisely, that evidence was ignored because, in a way, the pressure was coming from the other side, from the West. Western governments wanted to keep their own electorates happy, and their own electorates wanted to see aid going up.
Well, and it sounds very much, you know, you make the distinction between NGO aid and official government aid, and it sounds like much of the world outside of Africa doesn't really approach the subject with as much nuance.
I think that's true. I think for most people, aid is just aid, and they don't realize that there's key differences in how it's dispersed, and that there's a constant debate going on as to whether it's appropriate to give direct budgetary aid, for example. That's aid that goes straight into the coffers of the government concerned. Then there's humanitarian aid, which is preventing people from starving, and nobody wants that to be cut. And a large percentage of the Kenyan population is depending on that aid at the moment because there's been a drought, and it's pushed a lot of areas to the brink of famine. So, you know, you do have to make these distinctions. And people often don't. And I think one of the weaknesses, for example, of this recent book, Dead Aid, Dambisa Moyo's book, is that she does tend to take a sledgehammer approach to the issue. And you do have to make these distinctions. One of the reasons that Kenya's civil society is as vibrant and as provocative, and I mean that in a good way, and as challenging as it is towards its own government, is that it has received aid from the West, which has allowed people to work in that area, you know, and get salaries. And a lot of very bright young graduates have gone into civil society work and set up anti-corruption organizations. And that this is very good work that we want to see continuing. So these distinctions do matter.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. We're talking to Michaela Wrong about her new book, It's Our Turn to Eat. We have an email here from Bill who asks, do you think that deep down, anyone who gets to the top of political leadership in Kenya believes that to really try to reform the country is hopeless and that that sort of thinking is what leads to the inevitable corruption? And can a tribal society ever be any other way?
Well, I think one of the points I try and make in my book is that Kenya has this very strong history of tribal identity and tribal rivalry, and that has become one of the key problems in that country. But not all African countries are like that, and Kenya is also changing. And because you're having this big rush to the cities, you've got an increasingly urban population. And in a way, John was very typical of that urban population. They intermarry, they're educated in schools together, they date each other, they have friends from other ethnic communities. And so this notion that, oh, Africa's tribal and it's always going to be tribal and there's nothing that you can do about it, that's not true anymore. And the very slums that I described, in a way, are a source of hope because slums are multi-ethnic. And people mix together there, and they develop a different attitude and different expectations of their own government, and they tend not to see things in such radically ethnic terms anymore when they've been living cheek by jowl with people from other communities.
What was the reaction from within Kenya when the story broke about the scandal?
Well, it was one of a huge shock, and two of the ministers concerned stepped aside, and there was you've got these very unusual scenes in Kenya of ministers being sort of chased down corridors by camera crews asking them whether or not they were going to resign. But we have to say that the effect didn't last very long, and one of those ministers is back in cabinet, and his ministry, which is the energy ministry, has been associated with yet another major scandal. And I think there is this great complacency associated with the system in Kenya, that especially this President Mwai Kibaki has learned that if you keep your head down, you don't do anything, people will eventually tire of protest, and you will still be there when all the storm has blown over. And I think, sadly, what we've seen is there have been no prosecutions followed through on Anglo Leasing. The promised court cases haven't gone anywhere. They just bounced from the Attorney General to the head of the Kenya Anti-Corruption Commission. I don't think that we will ever see anyone prosecuted over that scandal. So the system, it's very hardy. It survives. And I think what we're going to see in future is we're going to see more people like John Githongo coming forward and calling it to account. But it's a tough struggle for sure.
When is President Kibaki up for re-election?
Well, the next elections are in 2012. And that's one that everyone now is thinking about, 2012, and who is going to be standing then. I don't expect Kibaki himself to stand in those elections because he's getting on in years, and there is a sense that the community that's backed him, they want a younger, more vibrant candidate. But I think that's actually become one of the problems, because the problems and the issues highlighted by my book, which desperately need to be addressed, nobody is addressing them, and they're just thinking, oh, you know, come the next election, we have to sort all this out after that. But the next election is all about who's going to run the country. And I don't see any vision coming from the political leadership at the moment. It's very depressing. And Kenya is in a really, really serious crisis at the moment, and I don't see the political regime tackling it at all.
Journalist Michaela Wrong is my guest. We're talking about her new book, It's Our Turn to Eat, The Story of a Kenyan Whistleblower. You can join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Michaela Wrong. Her new book is called It's Our Turn to Eat, The Story of a Kenyan Whistleblower. You can join us via email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. My understanding, Michaela, is that John Githongo would like to actually run for office himself in Kenya. Does he have a shot, do you think, at being elected?
At the moment, he's holding fire on those ambitions. Whenever I talk to him about it, he's very cagey. And I think there's a good reason for that, because after the elections that turned so sour, what happened is we saw a coalition government being set up, which included the opposition and the ruling party. And effectively, that government has now been tainted by several major corruption scandals, one involving fuel, one involving maize. And there's huge discontent in the public with not just the government, but also the MPs who refuse to see their salaries taxed and are widely seen as filling their boots while they have the opportunity. So a vast cynicism in Kenya towards the regime and parliament. And I think that this is not the time that someone who is idealistic and wants to change things would imagine going into government. I think that John is the kind of person who will eventually stand for election. But now is not the moment. And what he's actually doing is he's doing a lot of work at the grassroots. He's spending a lot of time in slums like Mathari, which is one of the biggest slums in Nairobi, and trying to assess what he can do at the community level. to prepare for what I think he sees as a coming storm. There is a great fear in Kenya that the kind of ethnic bloodletting that we saw after the last elections is going to break out again, either at the 2012 elections or before, because we've got a referendum on the constitution coming up. And I think John feels that it's time to be down there at the grassroots, working with the community and trying to see what can be done to prevent that happening.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Wosu in Grand Prairie. Hi, Wosu.
Hi. Thank you, Chris. As usual, I always appreciate your program.
Thank you.
Yeah. I have a comment and a question. And my comment is that I agree with the author because ethnicity and tribalism have really affected the development in Africa. Take Nigeria, for example, with all the natural resources, the country is still underdeveloped as a result of ethnicity and tribalism. But then my question in case of Kenya is, what is the government actually doing to separate the judiciary or empowering the judiciary to be independent so that they can function and control the corruption? And what is the religious leaders doing to empower ethical values in the society?
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's a very good question. It's interesting that when the Kibaki government came in and replaced Moi in 2003, one of their first priorities was to try and clean out the judiciary. And a lot of judges who had been regarded as politically tainted, as really doing the whim, obeying the whims of President Daniel Arap Moi, were retired. The problem is that this was done so effectively that you now have a real lack of qualified personnel in the judiciary. And so you have cases that never come to trial, people who languish in jail for years and years on remand, they've never been tried. And I think that there's a huge need for technical assistance, and that could actually be an area where Western aid would be very well used, which would just be getting the personnel in to get the judiciary going again. And it's, of course, the problem that your caller put his finger on is it's very easy to undermine the independence of the judiciary if you're a president who doesn't like to see your judges being too independent in their findings and their verdicts. It's a lot harder to build up that independence once it's been undermined. And I do think that we've had a systematic undermining of the judiciary pretty much since independence. And I know people, I've known one former judge who complains bitterly about the way he feels that his career was sabotaged because he wasn't bringing in the right verdicts. As for the religious leaders, I think it's very interesting to look at what Kenya's churches have done, the Catholic churches, the Protestant churches in particular. Anyone who knows Africa knows how incredibly influential the local clergyman is going to be, and the moral guidance that they give. And I think they're playing a very progressive role. On a very small parenthesis here, my book can't be bought in Kenya openly yet because booksellers don't want to sell it. And what you've seen instead is the churches coming together and they're saying, we're going to debate this book and we're going to make it available and we're going to sell it or give it to church groups so we can debate the issues of corruption and ethnicity and loyalty to your family and loyalty to your nation within the church. And I think that's a really far-sighted. I mean, obviously, I'm all for it, but it shows how much they're taking these issues to heart.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we'll talk to Nick in Arlington. Hello, Nick.
Yes, hello. Thank you for allowing me to ask my question.
Sure.
Yes, I really enjoy your show, and I have a two-part question. And the first part is there anything specific or different that the Obama administration can do that other American presidents could not do to help change the situation in Kenya? And also, is there any hope for typical Kenyans now that Obama is the president of America? We know that many Kenyans were very excited by the election of Obama. Is there anything he can do or different? And the second part of my question was, Kofi Annan just handed over the envelope containing the people who are responsible for the post-election violence in Kenya in 2007. Is there any way maybe the Western government need to put pressure on the International Criminal Court to go ahead and with the prosecution. Maybe that will do something towards pushing Kenya in the right track. And I'm going to take my question off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
It's difficult about the International Court. I think there is a fear in Kenya that that there are many ministers, serving ministers, whose names are on that list, who are identified as being the warlords who helped foment the post-election violence. And I think there is a fear in Kenya today that should they come up for prosecution, they would just rally their ethnic militias, because there is a problem now with militias out in the countryside who see their job as fighting on behalf of their champions, and that these militias would then go into action. So I think it's very problematical what's going to happen with the International Court. And some people in Kenya have been saying that what really will have to happen is there will have to be a pragmatic sort of arrangement where the people who distributed weapons and went around organizing trucks to people to pick people up and take them to the places where they then did the fighting and the burning of people's farms, they will end up being prosecuted, but that it would be almost too dangerous to prosecute people within government itself. And that may not be an ideal situation, and it's not really justice as we know it, but that may be what ends up happening there. As for Obama, I think the trouble is when you have a situation like this with a president who's got Kenyan roots being elected to the top job in the world, basically, then expectations are totally oversized and exaggerated. And Obama's first duty is not to Kenyan voters. It is obviously to American voters. And he has to take into account the fact that he has a recession and a credit crunch and that there are problems about Middle East peace and terrorism. And these are clearly going to be priorities. But I do think Obama can play a useful role in Kenya. And I think he already has, because he's been sending out a very strong message, and one that will be listened to in Kenya, which is that, you know, we know who we're dealing with here. Obama really understands Kenya, and he has no illusions about the regime that is running the country. And we're already hearing a much tougher line coming from the American ambassador in Nairobi on the need to clean up on the corruption, and the need to not foment further ethnic violence, and the need to see through the reforms that were agreed after the elections. And I think all this is very important stuff, and it's definitely been a change in tone since the Bush administration, and I very much welcome it.
How significant is it to either ordinary Kenyans or Kenyan government officials that President Obama's family is from the Luo group, and his father, in fact, was politically active?
I think it's tremendously important. I mean, it's not just in Kenya. Wherever you go in Africa, people have been just so overjoyed by the sight of someone with this African link getting into the White House. And there is a feeling that this man understands Africa and has a sympathy towards Africa that no other president ever had. And as a result, I think Obama he has leverage, and he can influence events in Africa, and particularly Kenya, in a way that no other president could have. So he does have a lot of cards that he can play there. And I very much welcome the tone of voice that we've been hearing from him when he was in Ghana just recently. Firstly, it was very interesting. He chose not to go to Kenya, and that, in a way, was delivering a rebuff to the regime in Kenya. And then he said some hard things about the Kenyan government while he was in Ghana, and some very warm things about the role being played by civil society. So I think that's been welcome. I would like to see him going to Kenya eventually. But I'm sure that if he did go to Kenya, that would be the approach maintained. Because if you read his book, Dreams of My Father, Obama really does understand Kenya, and he understands where this how this game of top-level sleaze has been played since independence, and why it's so difficult to eradicate.
Do to the extent that we can ever get any criminal prosecutions for the people who were involved in these kinds of scandals, is there any hope whatsoever for recovering some of the money that was stolen?
Well, if you talk to someone like John, he will say, we probably have to accept that these people are never going to spend time in prison. Prosecutions are a very distant prospect. But what we could expect and hope for would be restitution, and that there may have to be some deals done in future where the money is returned and these people are basically given amnesties. Now, that's the sort of technical discussion that people like John and people in the anti-corruption movement, a lot of people don't agree with him on that, and they really want to hold out for prosecutions. That's the debate taking place. But I mean, before we reach that stage, we do have to have an acknowledgement of what happened and some official verdict on who was responsible. And we're a long way from that at the moment.
Can you tell us anything about what happened to John Githango's staff after he exiled himself?
Yes. They were transferred elsewhere, most of them. This was something that preoccupied him a lot. And I know that before he came out with his dossier, he was very concerned that they should have jobs. One of his closest collaborators is now running Transparency International Kenya, which is a branch of the global anti-corruption movement. And she's producing reports and doing a lot of work on corruption in Kenya. It wasn't a huge unit. I mean, it was a fairly small unit, and maybe that was one of the problems, that it wasn't big enough and it didn't go deeply enough. I know that trying to find them birds elsewhere was one of his key considerations.
Miguela, what's the most important thing that needs to happen in order for Kenya to move toward a more open and honest system of government?
Yeah, that's such a big question.
I've left you 30 seconds to answer it.
I think we the country needs to accept what its problems are. There is, at the moment, there's this race going on for the next election. There's this obsession with naming the next candidate, the next presidential candidate. There is huge land hunger, a huge issue of land that's been stolen, often with the say-so of the political elite. And these issues that were gaping open when we went to the last elections, they've still not been resolved. Everyone knows what those problems are, and there's a great habit in Kenya of setting up commissions, producing reports, and never acting on them. And we really have to start tackling these issues seriously, not just kicking them into the long grass, and that's what's been happening up till now.
The new book by Miguela Wrong is called It's Our Turn to Eat, The Story of a Kenyan Whistleblower. Miguela, it's been great to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.